Hello there, and welcome to part two of my chat with Impressionist Rory Bremner. Last week, Her Majesty dropped by.
Couldn't you email me? Hey, well, I suppose if it has to be in person, I'll be in Ladbrokes in half an hour.
And this week, Prince Charles reveals he's just like the rest of us when it comes to a good box set.
I've been watching The Crown.
I have been watching The Crown. What do you think to it?
Don't tell me what happens. I've got to the beginning, you know, where I meet Diana. But don't tell me what happens. Spoiler alert. Sorry, what was your question?
Just carry on. Do you know, I'm just laughing so hard, Rory. I could just sit here all day. Do you just carry on?
Sorry.
I love it.
Oh, dear. Anyway, yes. So you had a question about Prince Charles or like something. Oh, did I meet him? Was it something like that? I can't remember.
Well, you know him, don't you? What was it like? Were you nervous the first time? I'm guessing you have mimicked him in front of him, have you?
Yeah, yes, I can't remember the first time. I think it was a Royal Variety show, probably, but you kind of always assume. That was a Royal Variety show, I think the first one, where somebody said, you're nervous? I said, yeah. They said, don't worry, look, just be yourself. I thought, that's great advice for an impressionist, isn't it? That's really, really good advice. Be yourself. Yeah, that's really useful. The one I remember was Stephen Fry rang up. It was Prince Charles's 50th, so it would be 1998. And Stephen Fry said, look, old chap, I wonder, was wondering if the British said, coming on, 50th birthday party at Highgrove, and I wonder if you'd come down and do a little skit. And so I thought, what can I do? And with John Langdon, we thought, why don't we do a Dr. Dolittle thing? But instead of talking to the animals, it was, if I could talk to the vegetables, learn their languages, give them all the nourishment they need. Imagine talking to a turnip, moaning to a mushroom. I could even talk in Swedish to a Swede. I could converse with the curly kale, rivet the radishes, introduce the mustard to the cress. There's no risk of impropriety with a fellow dwarf variety, because runner beans won't run off to the press. I'd chat in chard, in chicory, and in chervil. They'd never get a moment to themselves. When people ask me how it is I speak in broccoli, I say colloquially. How else? Just great fun. And I sent half the script to John and he sent the other half of the script back, which is just wonderful. You know, I love to share a hearty joke with an audience of artichoke. I know my onions, both the scallions and the springs. And that's where it came unstuck because, of course, Prince Charles is a very keen gardener. So I did that line. I know my onions, both the scallions and the springs. And he looked at me and he was saying, they're the same. And it's true, because scallions are spring onions. So there you go. So the Prince of Wales knows his onions.
Oh, that's good. That's good. And,
I will tell you one other story, because years later, I did the only play I've ever done, a Noel Coward play called Relative Values, which for some bizarre, in some casting accident, I was cast alongside Caroline Quentin and Patricia Hodge. It was just wonderful. I loved it. I was so, so lucky. As Noel Coward comedy. And one night we heard, oh, Prince Charles is in tonight. So he sort of sneaked in on his own. Anyway, about two or three days later, I got this letter backstage from Prince Charles saying, I can't tell you how much I enjoyed. I left the theatre feeling so much better than when I went in. And he was sweet about the cast and about how he'd met Noel Coward. And I remember he came to my 21st birthday dressed, I recall, in a brown velvet dinner jacket. And it was such a lovely thing because, you know, that he'd really enjoyed the evening, and I was playing a butler, and he said, I enjoyed your impression of the cultivated butler. So, I mean, I've always had a kind of great affection, I think, for Prince Charles, because he has a sense of humour, clearly. He always used to love the goons, and that wonderful time when he wrote a letter to Spike Milligan. They read it out in front of Spike Milligan, and he said, bloody crawler! Oh, no, he said something like, crawling bastard. Snivelling bastard. Which was even funnier. So, yeah, to get a kind of fan letter like that was really sweet. You know, I'm very old now, Alan, nearly 90.
You're not nearly 90. You're still 37, aren't you? I'm 37 now.
Oh, in some respects, I'd like to keep at 37. Yeah, that would be lovely. But what matters, and the coronavirus has taught us this as well, that what matters are the friendships, the relationships and the experiences. And you know, increasingly your life becomes, it's what Barry Cryer used to talk about and saying he's in his anecdotage now. And when you realise times that you spent with people We talked about David Frost earlier, didn't we? I mean, there was another great hero of mine. He was responsible for a lot of the shows I did. He didn't like me when I did his voice in later years. He said, "Do people's voices change as they get older?" And what he meant was, do I slur my words? But there was nobody like David Frost. He had those extraordinary parties in the summer, and you'd go along and he'd be the circus master. He'd be there in the garden outside and he would take it over and he'd greet you at the gate. "Oh, Rory, come in, meet the Pinochets." He did once say to John Lloyd, the producer of Spitting Image, he was introducing people at the way, he said, "Oh, John, come and meet, this is King... King Constantine." The name had escaped him. But I remember one Sunday lunch going down to Michelmersh, which is where David used to live, near Romsey in Hampshire. And we ended up playing a game of football. And David's guests, some of whom were godparents to his children, I was in midfield next to Michael Howard, a great Liverpool supporter, and he would dribble the ball in midfield. "It's all right, I'm not going to hurt you." So that was Michael Howard in midfield. In one goal was David Seaman of Arsenal, a godfather to one of David's sons. And in the other goal, Conrad Black. Can you believe that? Conrad Black, the most expensive pair of suede shoes you've ever seen. And the grass was wet, and so his suede shoes were sort of wicking. And you could see it's sort of watermark going up these expensive brindle or sort of ginger suede shoes. And there he was, I mean, this sort of media tycoon, sort of a little bit like, I think he might have been being played by Orson Welles at the time, but Orson Welles playing Conrad Black. And I remember I told John Fortune when I got back, I said, "You won't believe this." And he said, "What was he using to save the goal? Was he using gloves or injunctions?"
And also, you know, from that kind of era, I mean, wasn't it Terry Wogan, who I absolutely loved, who really gave you that first TV and radio break?
The old Helen Fussbarrow. Yeah. It was. It's a long time ago, and it never happened. But yeah, it was my very first break. I was doing the Edinburgh Festival. And this would be 1984, before you were born, Helen. I was doing a show with Mark Steele, I mentioned earlier, and Jenny A. Clare at a Masonic Lodge in Edinburgh. And the BBC came along and they said, "Oh, great, lovely, we'd love to feature you in our highlight show. In fact, could you do all the voices? Why don't you link the show? You doing David Attenborough and Clive James and Russell Harty and all these voices." So, yeah, great. And then Terry Wogan, it was on Radio 2, and I think the trailer, and Terry Wogan picked up on it and said, "Here's a bloke who does voices that I've not heard before." And so he kind of championed me on his radio show. And then, as time and chance would have it, he had his first of his BBC TV shows, 1985, when he went to 3 nights a week, do you remember, Monday, Wednesday and Friday?
I do. I loved him.
And so he had me on the first of his shows. And I was on this show. Can you imagine? It was terrifying. It was me. I've got the billing all wrong. I'll put me at the end here, because the others were Elton John, Tina Turner and Wendy Richard. God bless Wendy Richard. And they gave me some colossal sort of about 7 or 8 minutes stand-up and a bit of conversation with him. And that was it. Sort of, you know, the agent's phone rang off the hook the next day. And that was my big break. And he was always, you know, we always look back to those days. I was at his memorial service with the lovely Helen, the present Mrs. Wogan. He always used to call her the current Mrs. Wogan. And he knew how to live, and great friends with Peter Alice, of course. I loved his golf. There's quite a few sort of Irish broadcasters. Henry Kelly was another. Graham Norton, of course, and Dara O'Brien and Ed Byrne. And, you know, there's a wit about Irish. There's an intelligence. You know, it goes back to Wilde and Sheridan and all that. That was present with Terry as well. You knew that deep down he was from Limerick. And he said, "Well, I know things. Things might be bad. Things might be bad, but they're not serious."
Your ears were burning, actually, in our podcast a couple of weeks ago, because we interviewed the Queen of Comedy, Dr. Maria Kempinska.
Oh, yes, John of Glurs, course. Of course. All right.
And she was talking about how post-university days you came to John Glurs and performed and everything. But what it made me realise is you and I have known each other for a long, long time, but I don't really know much about your background or how you even got into all this in the first place. So it's sort of in a nutshell. Can you just give me a flavour of those early years? I know you studied languages at university.
Okay, well, there's lots of things there because Maria was my first agent, of course, because and I was doing shows, and that was not after university. That was contemporaneously, it's a long word, at the same time as university. So I'd have seminars in the day, I'd get my essays done in the library, and then off I'd go in the evening to the cabaret circuit. And it wasn't uncommon to do three shows in an evening. You'd start off at the Finborough Arms, then jump on the Piccadilly line, zoom up to Islington, to the Hemingford Arms, and then somehow or other wangle your way back down to Battersea, where Jongleurs was. So, okay, right, background. Born in Edinburgh. Dad was a soldier who left the army in 1953 before I was born and became the appeals secretary for the cancer research campaign and ultimately died of cancer, ironically, when I was doing my A-levels. But the reason I mentioned him was we did a Who Do You Think You Are? I was very, very lucky to do this. I mean, wonderful chances you get to do a show like Who Do You Think You Are, which takes you back into your family history. And, you know, I thought, oh, my God, they're going to find a great-grandfather who swam up the Zambezi or something like that, or, you know, or a great-grandmother who single-handed, who married a Zulu chief. But, you know, I ended up in a train going across Holland in the rain. I thought, God, this isn't very good. And it wasn't a distant relative. It was my dad. But, you know, I found out what he'd done in the Second World War and which side he was. Which is a relief. He was on our side. So that was Dad and Edinburgh childhood. I went to school just outside Edinburgh and then was sent to Wellington down near Reading, where James Hunt had been to school there, and also I think Will Young went to Wellington. Enjoyed school, was kind of gregarious, did sport, and started doing impressions of teachers. And that suddenly people used to love that. I was a bit of a class clown, which I now realise was one of the kind of features of my ADHD, which is my sort of limited attention span and jumping all over the place. You've had to suffer some of that in the last half hour or so. So the brain does bounce around a little bit. And I was so started doing impressions. People enjoyed those. And I thought at the back of my mind, I remember performing once for a friend, Chris Cox, in fact, his name was. And Chris Cox had a party and some friends. And I was doing Rowan Atkinson sketches and impressions of that and Monty Python and stuff like that. And people were laughing. And I thought, ooh, maybe I should do this. And people say, oh, you should do this properly. And so that was 1979. I went to Berlin as part of my gap year, then did languages in London. But that gave me the chance to do lectures and seminars and languages in the day and cabaret in the evening. And it was meeting people like Chris Barry, who was the original Spitting Image voice. He did Reagan, he did Russell Harty, he did all the big Spitting Image voices. And he was about 3 or 4 years ahead of me on the cabaret circuit. But there it was. I was at university and the cabaret circuit in London. Started out on that, went up and did an Edinburgh festival back in my hometown and was discovered by the BBC and Wogan, and the rest is history. So there you go. Edinburgh childhood, London university, and downhill ever since.
You touched on the fact there that you have ADHD, but you were only actually formally diagnosed, if you like, in the last few years. Did you always suspect that perhaps you had something like that?
I said formally. I think I was informally diagnosed many years before. Yeah, I mean, I kind of self-diagnosed. I think it was pretty obvious. But then, you know, so many performers and entertainers and comedians are anyway. Lee Mack, for example. Because his speed of thought and his irrepressibility, and you just love it about him, but he's clearly sort of got galloping ADHD, and I recognise it. And how he has dealt with it has been, he has found a career and a vocation and a job where it's a fantastic asset.
I'm phoning from EDF. I said, I'm not interested. He said, I haven't told you what it is yet. I said, I know exactly why you're ringing. You're ringing to offer me a free season ticket to Wembley plus unlimited access to Dirty Brenda's all-night knocking shop with as many chocolate hobnobs as I can eat. He said, no, I'm not. I'm ringing to talk about your domestic fuel bills. I said, well, why didn't you say that in the first place? He said, can I ask you, who's your current supplier? I said, oh, it's Big Pete. He comes round every Thursday on a moped. I said, oh, sorry, gas. I thought you meant electricity. I said, it's British Gas. He said, can I ask what you chose them, sir? I said, well, it's a funny story. I needed some gas. And I live in Britain, and I don't know what it was, but they seem to be ticking all the right boxes. And at this point, he genuinely got the hump and said, do you know what, I think I'll ring someone else who'll answer my questions less sarcastically. I said, yeah, you can phone someone else, they'll be less sarcastic, they'll probably stay on the phone longer, but they'll still end up saying no to you anyway. I said, now, I don't know who's providing your current rejection, but if you were to switch to me, I would combine the rejection with the sarcasm and save you up to 15% a year on your cold calling time. And do you know what he did then? Do you know what he did? He tried to offer me Nectar points.
One of the features of ADHD, you know, I call it my best friend and my worst enemy, because there are positives and negatives. There are strengths and there are weaknesses. But one of the strengths and weaknesses, because they, as you get older, you realize that the two are completely interchangeable, is that a feature of ADHD is the part of your brain which regulates impulsivity is deficient, if you like. So that thing that keeps you on the rails, as it were, is in the case, and they know this from brain scans, because the science is catching up fast with ADHD. You know, we know this now. We know that the pathways, the networks, the parts of the brain where impulsivity is controlled are less formed in the case of ADHD people. Now, it doesn't really help if you're in the classroom and you're trying to concentrate, your brain's all over the place. But boy, does it help if you're a comedian, and because you get to the joke very quickly before other people. And even if it's at the same time as other people, they're then going through the editing process of saying, should I say that? Oh, I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't say that. But boom, if you're a comedian, bam, out it comes. So it's a classic way of dealing with ADHD. And the best way is over time, and you realize that there's a lifestyle or a vocation or a way of life that suits it perfectly. And it might be a sport, because you've got such, the H of ADHD stands for hyperactivity. So you find that Michael Phelps, for example, or Simone Biles, who's the greatest gymnast, you know, when the Russians hacked her medical records, lo and behold, she's on Ritalin.
So under my random headings now, I've got translating operas, Tusk, show jumping dad.
Right.
Shall we join those together somehow? Because I know you love opera and you translate and...
Yeah, that, the mentioned languages, so French and German is what I did. I did Russian as an O-level. And I'm actually trying to learn a bit of Italian now. As lockdown, I thought I've done nothing. People say, what did you do in lockdown? Did you use sourdough bread? No, I didn't. Did you eat banana? No, I didn't. Did I cycle up Kilimanjaro? No, I didn't. But I thought, well, okay, it's only this little, you know, language app on a phone that keeps nagging me and saying, you haven't done your 5 minutes of Italian. So I love languages. And years ago, I used to go out with somebody who loved opera. And so I ended up going to a few operas. And somebody put the two together and said, listen, we're going to do this. Charles Hazelwood and Mark Dornfer May was the director. And Charles Hazelwood was a brilliant conductor. And they said, we want to do this Kurt Weill play, musical rather, like an opera, set in the 1930s, just before Hitler took over at that time simultaneously, which is why Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht had to leave Germany and go to America. And they said, look, we know you do languages, you like opera, would you like to translate this from German? I said, yeah, okay, great. So off I went. And I'd always wanted to do a translation. So I did that one for them. And then I did Carmen, which is from French into English. And we did that in South Africa with a cast taken from the townships, because they went around first looking for opera singers in South Africa. And they kept getting what I call these 10 to 2 tenors, who plant their feet at 10 to 2 and go, La donna mobile, la 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 la. And thought, yeah, okay, that's good. But, and then they thought, no, sod this, we're getting into the townships. And they went into the townships and they found these amazing singers, these amazing natural voices. And they auditioned. And the auditions, it was like for a job. It's like, you know, are you going to go for a job at McDonald's or are you going to do this opera show? And so they signed up and they ended up less than a year later on the West End in London, with London in the palm of their hand, each and every one of them and the cast supporting 10, 15, 20 people back home doing, it was originally their first, before they did the mysteries, like the old medieval mystery plays, saddlers and coopers and blacksmiths and stuff like that, would they go around the towns and the villages performing the mystery plays. And it was a version of that. But they wanted to do Carmen, and we did it in Speer, just outside Cape Town. By the time I got there, they translated a lot of it back into Xhosa. And then they made a film largely in Xhosa, which won the Berlin Film Festival or something. So that was the French one. I've not done an Italian one yet, but ended up doing a play, a Bertolt Brecht play, which James Corden was in at the Young Vic. So yeah, I love that. So I love the exercise of getting the headphones, playing the CD, you get the score, so, you know, the musical score, so you can identify where the notes are and stuff, and the original script. And I try not to get a hold of another translation, because that puts their words into your head. You want to translate, I mean, like Seven Deadly Sins, another Kurt Weill thing. And I thought, I don't want to know, has this been translated before? And I Googled it. And I said, who did the last translation? And they said, oh, W.H. Auden. And I thought, oh, well, good luck with that, Rory. But actually, I think he probably dashed it off quite quickly, as did Brecht.
But anyway.
I've got a bit of toss because you mentioned Tusk. Africa there. Now, I was chatting to lovely Charlie Mayhew, who's the CEO of Tusk. We did a podcast with him a few weeks ago. And looking at clips of you in a downpour in Mozambique, you were so drenched on this sort of piece to camera, if you like, that you took your T-shirt off and rang it out on camera because it was just so wet.
There kind of comes a point in every documentary when actually clothes are pretty superfluous, because I think if I take my mic off, there's no point. If you can't beat him, join him.
I mean, you've had some real adventures, haven't you, with Toss?
God, that was an outtake, wasn't it? I haven't seen that one.
I'm going to send that to you.
Poor people seeing that. Well, okay. Lots of things going on there because Charlie Mayhew and I were at school together.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
So, yeah, we were at school together. So Charlie and I have known each other. Let's see, we met at 13 at school and we're now 59. So that means we've known each other for 46 years.
No.
Is that right?
No, that can't be right.
That's my math. 46. Yeah, we've known 46, each other for 46
yes.
years, and he'd be as horrified as I am. Anyway, so yeah, I don't know where he went on to. I went to London University, don't know where he went. And then he just surfaced some years later as this amazing founder of this charity that does so much for wildlife conservation and for the communities in all parts of Africa, in Kenya, in Mozambique, in Tanzania, in Zimbabwe, and just incredible. And there was a time in my life, I got divorced in 95, and I had sort of 5 years before I met the current Mrs. Morgan, before I met Tessa, who I'm married to now. I had sort of 5 years of being on my own and being able to just take up any opportunity or go anywhere or do anything. And one of those was to go to Africa. Charlie asked me to be a patron of Tusk. And I said, yeah, great, love to do that. And he said, oh, you must come. It's bloody funny, actually. Charlie said, it's bloody funny. He said, well, you must go to Kenya. Great, lovely. He's not posh like that, really. But his voice is a little bit like that. And so, yeah, then next thing I know, I'm with Charlie, sitting around a campfire on Lewa Downs somewhere. And those were very, very happy, brilliant, wonderful years. I mean, there's nothing like it. I'd like to take my children, who are now 19 and 17, on a safari, because there's nothing like the first time that you see an animal in the wild. I remember the first time I saw an elephant and just realizing that it had, there were no boundaries there. It wasn't in a zoo. It just existed there, where it had come from, where it was going to, whatever. It was literally wildlife. And I thought, how just the beauty and the nobility and the majesty and those huge African skies. So, yeah, I loved that. In fact, Tessa and I ended up going to Lewa Downs on honeymoon because we went to a hotel in Mauritius and we were papped. And they took topless photographs of Tessa and the headlines were Mrs. Rory's crowning glory. So that was a telephone call from her mother later. Said, darling, you're in the papers. And her father saying, don't worry, I can't really see because the staples are in the way or something like that. So we hot-footed it hopped from Mauritius back to Africa and spent most of our honeymoon at Lewa Downs. So Charlie Mayhew introduced, I think we're still Tusk's first breeding couple.
So he is the Cilla Black of Tusk, really, isn't he?
Surprise, surprise.
I've never been to Africa and seen animals in the wild like that, but Charlie has promised that we will find a filming opportunity at Lewa. So we need to message you and get you involved in that. So the final category on my list, on my day-long chat with Rory, because I could talk to you all day and all week, really, is the fact that you're a show-jumping dad.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yes, the aforementioned Tessa, I didn't do my due diligence. She's one of three daughters in Scotland, in the borders, and in the Scottish borders, you know, horses and the countryside, sort of wide open countryside, sort of very big. And so their childhood was just charging around on horses everywhere. So when our daughters were born, they were on ponies and stuff quite young. And Ava, the 19-year-old, loved it. You know, she sort of then sort of just liked sort of hacking around and loved all. But Lila, 17, had a real sort of aptitude for it. And she went from, you know, doing junior sort of pony club stuff. We bought a horse, a pony, about sort of 4 years ago that had only jumped
you know, about the height of the table or something, and was very young, 7 or 8. And she took it over the next 2 years up to jumping sort of about 125, meter 25, to the European team, the British team that went to Poland in the summer of 2018, it would be, and they won the silver. They were just pipped in by Ireland in an amazingly exciting show jumping final. It was so exciting that John Magner, who's a great horse racing supporter, sponsor, owner, and he said it was the best day of sport he'd seen in his life. And he's absolutely, he was converted. His grandson was competing for Ireland and they beat us by a second in the jump off, which over four horses, four rounds, you know, 1 second in it. So exciting. And so, yeah, Lila loves it. So she's now, you have to move out of ponies and you have to get into horses. And so now, you know, she's making her way. She's still finishing her A-levels. We're trying to keep her on the straight and narrow. But, you know, she's been taking part. She's ridden at Olympia and she's ridden in Portugal last year. And, you know, she'd be in classes with some of the younger horses, but with some of the great Olympic riders, like John Whittaker, for example. It's a big class of sort of 40 or 50, but nevertheless, if you can manage to finish in the top 20 or something, and you're with some of the names that you've grown up watching and listening. And so it's very exciting, but it has its, she had bad injuries last year. She got kicked in the knee and it broke her kneecap. And she had a very nasty pearler of a fall at Chard in Somerset, where she and the horse parted company at the very top of its jump, and she hit the ground with a thump and was clipped by the horse and knocked unconscious. So when we got to her, we thought, God, she's not moving. She's not moving. And then when she opened her eyes, her pupils didn't dilate and there was blood coming out of her ear and everything. And we just all thought, oh, Lord. It was terrifying. And they got the air ambulance in and they assessed her. And at that moment, we were thinking, if they say we're going to have to fly her to Frenchay, we're going to know it's a very serious injury. But they say they assessed her and they said, no, it is okay. She can go by road to Taunton, I think they went to. And so, I mean, really well looked after her, and they scanned her and discharged her, and she had sort of bad concussion. But that was terrifying. And she lost a couple of teeth, were kicked out. So there's a downside. But, you know, it's a risky sport, but it's also a riveting sport. It's something that, I mean, Britain, we do, I mean, you go to Olympia and you realise that just the extent of this sport, the children and horses and ponies, it's a massive, massive thing. And don't forget, when you and I were younger, Helen, you probably remember watching on Grandstand or something. They used to have, you know, from Hixted Derby or something, and Raymond Brooks Ward was saying, and now David Broomhorn on Sanyo Sazan, Hi-Fi System, Stereo, and there's Harvey Smith on all of that. And that was primetime telly.
I remember that.
But I think we do have there's a British love of horses, and, you know, we always do pretty well in the Olympics. And, of course, we've got the Olympics coming up later this year.
We certainly have.
Scott Brash and Ben Mayer and two or three places that, you know, it's very exciting as to who's going to go, if they can get abroad, because Scott Brash has already been turned back, I think, 3 times trying to get into France because he hasn't got the right paperwork.
Oh, crumbs. And that's a whole other subject. The sun's come out because I can see the sun shining on your face.
Yeah,
you've got a shower head to order, essential.
I'll show you. There's what's
show me the shower head. Oh, no, that's this. Oh, look at that. Gosh, you're in the countryside somewhere beautiful. Very,
you can
very
see
nice.
There's the white horse, you can see.
Yeah,
there's
a
dark horse, you can see.
God, this is lovely.
Can you see anything? Anyway.
Rory, thank you so much.
This is great radio,
isn't it? This is great radio. It's been brilliant. I knew it would be great fun having you as a guest. And I've really enjoyed the sort of romp that we've had through your world and your wonderful collection of friends. Leave us with a thought from one of your favourites, if you would.
Leave you with a thought from one of my favourites? Mm. Good Lord.
Who's your favourite? Who would say goodbye on our podcast?
A reprise from, I could think of something. What would I leave you with? I'd love to be wonderfully, wonderfully inspired by something. May the road rise up to greet you, as Terry Wogan would say. Say, may all your enemies be friends. May the road rise up to greet you and enjoy your life.
That was Impressionist Rory Bremner. Shortly after we recorded our podcast, Rory was instrumental in helping Park Lane Stables in Teddington reach their goal of urgently raising £1 million against all the odds to stay open and continue making riding accessible for everyone, including disabled children.
Hi, folks. If I were to tell you that there's a very special place in southwest London where anyone, whether they're young or old, disabled or able-bodied, could go and ride or groom or just spend some quality time with horses, it might warm your heart. If I were to tell you that their lease is up, and unless they raise over £1 million, they would have to close their doors forever, it might break your heart.
But if I were to tell you that with a week to go, they have raised over £1 million, it might lift your heart, make you want to chip in to guarantee the future at this very special place for all the people to whom it means the world. So go online and look up Save Our Stables and see if you can chip in and make something of a miracle happen.
I love stables. I love stables. I'm a very stable genius, and I approve this message.
And next week on the Convex Conversation, we'll be talking to the lady who masterminded that campaign with her 7-year-old son, Woody, who has Down syndrome. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to download and subscribe at convex.podbean.com or find us on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts, Pipped, or Ask Alexa.